That's a Christmas present from a very dear friend of mine.
Look, Daddy, teacher says every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings.
That's right. That's right.
Attaboy, Clarence.
You know that scene from the holiday movie, the holiday movie, the 1947 classic, It's a Wonderful Life. Time now to look back at some of the best movies of this year. For KCRW's Best of 2019, we turn now to Alonzo Duralde and Dave White, film critics for The Wrap and co-hosts of the podcast Linoleum Knife. Dave has his top movie picks first.
Shall I read them to you? The Lighthouse, The Souvenir, The Load, The Irishman, and Black Mother.
Okay. Alonzo.
Pain and Glory, Booksmart, Parasite, Little Women, Marriage Story.
We're not going to talk about all of them. We'll do three each in the interest of parody.
Sure.
And begin with Dave with a Serbian film called The Load. Tell us about that.
It is the second feature from a man whose name I will destroy right now, Ondjen Glavonic. It is set in 1999. A man drives a truck during the NATO bombing of Serbia from Kosovo to Belgrade. The cargo of this truck is unknown, and he doesn't ask. And when he's stopped at checkpoints, he has information that he hands the police, and they just wave him through. So there's something going on.
Do we know what the cargo is?
Nope, we don't know.
Will we ever find out?
No. While this is a death-defying trip, this isn't the kind of film that you're thinking of when you're thinking of thriller. It is cold and bleak and austere, and it is more about the consequences of participating in a situation where there is no good choice. And that's, you know, it's war, so that's an understatement. Subtextually, it's about the atrocities and the genocide that we know from wars like this. But it's not showy on any level. It is this sort of gray, austere, cold,
you're really selling it.
Bitter slap in the face.
The slowest of burns.
And ultimately, it is about who is evil and is it you?
That sounds fascinating.
It's one of the best films.
But also, I wouldn't have put it on my list.
It doesn't
feel like a warm and fuzzy date movie.
Nope.
That you, yeah, okay.
Nope, so, not at all.
All right, speaking of not necessarily warm and fuzzy, but Pedro Almodovar, you normally associate him with at least wacky and interesting.
I mean, you know, this is the guy who made The Skin I Live In. So,
right,
you know,
that's true.
You don't necessarily know what you're going to get when he comes
suddenly. So Pain and Glory on your list.
Pain and Glory, very autobiographical film. Antonio Banderas, giving perhaps the performance of his career, plays an aging filmmaker. He has various physical ailments. He is dealing with anxiety and depression and hasn't worked for years. One of his older films has just been restored and is about to screen, which prompts him to reunite with the actor who is the lead in that film. They haven't spoken since the premiere. They had a falling out. And over the course of reconnecting with the actor and then through that reconnecting with what we might consider the great love of his life, you see this filmmaker coming to a reckoning with his past that includes his childhood. His mother's played by Penelope Cruz in the flashback scenes, and sort of figures out, you know, how to move forward from where he is. It is a haunting film. It's beautiful and it's melancholy, but it is, you know, so full of life in the way that Almodovar's work is. It has those visual flourishes and it has that empathy and occasional moments of absurdity, and it's stunning.
Okay, that's Pain and Glory by Pedro Almodovar. Dave, you chose a documentary called Black Mother. Here's
yes.
a clip.
Hallelujah, praising the name of the Lord. I tell you thanks now while I commit him in your hands, Jesus. Hallelujah, and I beg of you to let thy will be done. Amen, amen,
okay.
And amen.
Amen.
Amen. Khalik Allah, he's a New York filmmaker, and this is a documentary about Jamaica. His family is from there, and he's visited there, you know, many times through the course of his life. So he, on a couple of trips, he started filming family members, some folks he didn't know at all, and then layered sound over it. So what we have here is a documentary, I guess, in quotes, but also a real documentary, a collage-like, non-narrative, and I put that in quotes too, but still delivering plenty of elusive references to stories and people, some that are very close to him. But in making this sort of swirl of visuals and sound, he is weaving together histories of Jamaican culture, of oppression, slavery and colonialism that dominated that country, nutrition in some moments, corporate control of culture, all of that under a rubric of pregnancy and childbirth. Mm. And that's sort of what the loose structure of the film is.
And the title, Black Mother.
Yeah. And it is a gorgeous, immersive experience. In his words, he calls it a baptism. And by the end of it, you think, okay, yeah, I think I just was. Mm-hmm. It's really incredible.
All right. Alonzo on many a best of 2019 list, Marriage Story, directed by Noah Baumbach, starring Scarlett Johansson and Adam Driver.
Charlie and I are getting a divorce, Mom. You can't be friends with him anymore.
Gina?
Charlie Bird.
Mom? Mom?
What?
Okay. Alonzo, you love this one.
Oh, my God. Yeah, this movie is it's an experience. We begin with Scarlett Johansson and Adam Driver's characters each sort of reciting these essays that they've written about what they love about the other person. And it's very sweet and it's very insightful and you really get a sense of why what brought these people together and everything. And then you find out that this is an exercise that they have done as part of the process of getting a divorce. And the whole rest of the movie is about the dissolution of the marriage, which gets complicated because they have a child who's like 7 years old and is in school. And, you know, he's a theater director who's based in New York and she's an actress who's getting opportunities in Los Angeles. So they become bi-coastal. You know, originally they're going to just sort of, you know, do it in a very friendly way. But then lawyers get involved and you know how that goes. And it is this really just emotionally wrenching film about the DNA of a relationship and what it looks like when it comes apart. And, you know, I've heard some people say that it leans too heavily in one side or the other. For me, I felt my allegiances were constantly shifting. Sometimes I thought, oh, well, you know, he's in the right and she's terrible. And I thought, no, she knows what she's doing and he's being awful. And by the end of the film, I thought, no, both of these people are trying to do what's best for themselves, for their child. And it's just, it's difficult and it's complicated and it's messy, but they're going to get there. And the movie does provide some hope that there is an end to this, but it's an emotional minefield along the way. But it's also very funny, you know. I mean, Baumbach, I think, is really on a roll. I mean, this is like his fourth or fifth film in a row that I think is just spot on. You know, I really felt like I got to know these characters and care about them. And, you know, for a year that had a lot of Sondheim popping up everywhere, from Joker to Knives Out to The Morning Show, Adam Driver's rendition of Being Alive from Company is one of the great gut punch scenes of the year.
Okay, Dave, Martin Scorsese, The Irishman.
Frank Sheeran. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, you said it right.
Under the contract, management can only fire a driver on very specific charges. So, do you have a show up late?
No.
Do you have any moving violations?
No.
Do you drink on the job?
No.
You ever hit anybody?
On a job?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
All right, then. We don't have nothing to worry about.
You like the real light and sunny movies.
That is correct. Upbeat. I'm a real up person.
The Irishman, why is it on your list?
Well, this is the return of Martin Scorsese with Robert De Niro and Al Pacino. De Niro plays a hitman who killed Jimmy Hoffa. And so,
let's just put it out there.
The movie would have us believe. And it's a pretty convincing case.
Not solved.
The book that it's based on, yes. I Heard You Paint Houses. Mm-hmm. And so this takes us through decades of Sheeran's life and his career as a murderer and as friend of Jimmy Hoffa, but who doesn't take a moment to think about what the end game of this is. And this is a film about the end game. Now that you've had your Goodfellas fun, and everyone around you is gone, and your family no longer wants to even be near you, what are you left with?
This is a movie where every time we're introduced to a new mobster, it tells you on screen how they died. And almost all of them, it's like, you know, two bullets in the head in a parking garage. Like, it's always something. Very few of them get natural causes.
And so if you walk in thinking, oh, cool, I love a Scorsese mob picture. Well, this is when the other shoe drops. And it becomes this reckoning about how have you lived your life?
Well, it seems similar to the Almodovar.
I was going to say, yeah, I think The Irishman and Pain and Glory would make an interesting double feature because they are about not only the physical effects of aging, but also the sort of emotional element of what have you done with your life? Who have you held close to you? Who's going to be there for you when you need them?
Except in the Almodovar film, Antonio Banderas doesn't run around, you know, murdering people for hire.
On screen.
Exactly. What do we know?
The performances here are astounding. De Niro and Pacino.
Joe Pesci.
You haven't seen Pacino and De Niro be this good in a film in years.
Is Pacino doing his yelling thing, or is he
he's being directed.
Yeah, it's he isn't. He isn't. It's nuanced. But the performance I really can't stop thinking about is a sort of two-person performance. Lucy Galena, child actress, playing De Niro's daughter when she's young, and then Anna Paquin playing her when she's older. These two don't have any scenes together because they're playing the same person, but they deliver a unified performance that amounts to about 12 words between the two of them, and it's all about the way they are looking at Robert De Niro every time the camera you know, pointedly goes to their face. And it's chilling and heartbreaking. And they are sort of like the stand-ins for the audience. You know, you put yourself in that place and you think, well, I wouldn't be the hitman. I would be the hitman's family. Mm-hmm. And what would happen to me? You know, where would I go with this person when I found out what they did for a living and how what predicated my entire life?
And for a film that's melancholy, it's actually quite funny for a lot of it as well.
Yes.
I mean, there's an extended bit involving Jesse Plemons and a fish that is one of the funniest things I've seen in a movie all year.
Yeah.
Jesse Plemons, under-talked about. He's really good in Breaking Bad. And
he makes it work.
Everywhere he goes.
He's great.
Fargo.
I don't like to, you know, throw this word around, but this is a late career masterpiece, and it's exciting to see it in its moment and know that 20 years from now people will be calling this that word.
Wow. All right, finally, Booksmart.
We haven't done anything. We haven't broken any rules.
Name one person whose life was so much better because they broke a couple of rules.
Picasso.
He broke art rules.
Rosa Parks.
Name another
Susan
one.
Susan B. Anthony.
Damn it.
Alonzo, this is on your list.
Yes. Well, you'll recall, Madeline Brand, when we were in here when the movie came out, Dave outed me to the world that I sweated through this entire movie, which is how
I remember that.
Sign of like a movie I'm really into.
I think you did.
Yeah, this movie earned my perspiration. It is a great, great comedy starring Caitlin Dever and Beanie Feldstein as two senior tryhards who realize on the eve of their graduation that they didn't have to like brown nose and suck up so much to get into the schools of their choice, that everybody else had fun and also managed to get into to great colleges. So they give themselves this night to just go buck wild. And obviously much is revealed about their character and their friendship. And we've seen this kind of teen trope, the one crazy night, you know, done ad infinitum over the course of cinema. But this movie is so intelligent and insightful and empathetic about these characters and draws the people around them with such richness. There's these wonderful, like, just daffy and completely recognizable supporting characters, whether it's the sort of the girl who seems like she's from another dimension, the drama kids, the rich guy who's trying desperately to have people like him. Yeah, I just was delighted by this movie from start to finish. And it I think it was just, you know, Olivia Wilde makes one of the great directorial debuts of this year. I can't wait to see what she does next.
Okay, well, it's safe to say from what we've seen so far that you two represent maybe the yin and yang, the positive and negative, the sunshine and the
clouds,
midnight darkness.
This is why our marriage works so well.
And our podcast.
All right. Well, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Madeline.
Maybe. If the, you're supposed to say, if there is one. All right. If you want the full Best of 2019 list with more information about each film and trailers, find it on our website, kcw.com. Alonzo Duralde, Dave White, a married couple, a happily married couple. Review for The Wrap and co-host the podcast, Linoleum Knife.
Happy New Year.
Thank you.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
You're back with KCRW's Best of 2019. Happy holidays. I'm Steve Chiotakis. If you can look forward to some time off over the holidays, at least a bit of a slowdown at the office, it can be a great time to check out some of Greater LA's fantastic food offerings. And I have with me the perfect person to make recommendations when it comes to the phenomenal eats in and around Greater Los Angeles. Of course, that is Evan Kleiman. She's the host of KCRW's show, Good Food. Hello, Evan.
Hello, Steve.
Happy holidays to you, by the way.
Same to you. And I have to say that the fact that people leave the city in droves means that those of us who stay have so much less traffic.
So you like that, do you?
Well, for getting to restaurants that you would normally think twice about because they're like on the other side of town. No
or
problem.
Even getting into the restaurant, right? Like a reservation or something like that.
That's true.
You have put together a list of five of your favorite restaurants for people to check out. I noticed that you describe these as neighborhood restaurants. What do you think is the significance of that? Does that represent a particular kind of restaurant?
Yes. Well, first of all, I would say that the producer of Good Food, Nick Liao, and I did this list together.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I didn't want to do a best of because I don't know. I just think that that is not my comfort zone.
Okay.
I wanted to do more where I love to eat and where Nick loves to eat and where we go to over and over again. Yeah. And I think the neighborhood restaurant is in some jeopardy. And
you mean like a mom and pop restaurant, something like that?
Yeah, individual owner operator. I think it's a tougher road to hoe. And so to support these kinds of small restaurants is the good thing to do.
Well, let's talk about those restaurants then. You start with one place in Highland Park, a restaurant there called Joy. Tell us about it.
Well, Joy is Vivian Koo's Taiwanese Cafe. That's on York Boulevard. It's just things you really want to eat at prices that you can pay. So all the cold salads are just incredible. So you get like lotus root, which is one of my favorite things, super crisp, bathed in chili oil. There's bamboo shoots or like sliced pig ears if you want to go for that. It's sort of like the greatest hits of Taiwanese antipasti. And then some really great, more meaty dishes like the Lu Ru Fun, which is the soy-based minced pork on rice with pickles and a stewed egg. It's just the kind of food that's delicious, super satisfying, delivered in a format that's really affordable and accessible.
All right, well, let's go a little south and east from Taiwan to Thailand and from Highland Park to Thai Town. You like a restaurant in Thai Town. This is called Northern Thai Food Club.
Well, you should know this about me. I love places that are barely restaurants.
Yeah.
I think that's also a theme in this list.
Like one level off of, you know, like a food truck, right?
I like the serendipity of coming into a space that isn't super curated and just eating. It doesn't have to be dining to me.
Yeah. Even if it's like at a stool or something, right?
Yeah,
at a bar.
It's fine.
Yeah.
Or if it's so small that you might have to pick it up to take it home. And this place only has 12 seats. So definitely Northern Thai Food Club is one of those places that you might end up just going in, looking at her steam table, which Chef Amphai Dunn, she cooks from Northern Thailand, as you would guess from the title. And she does a lot of really wonderful warming stews and things that you may not have seen. It's almost like she's cooking like a home cook in a tiny restaurant setting. So the kind of food you're getting is different than you're going to get anywhere else. The thing that people all love, if all the meat eaters, are eating the grilled sausage. Her grilled Thai sausage is unbelievable.
Really?
Yes, super lemongrassy with turmeric. But she also has, there's a wonderful dip called Nam Prik Num that is just, it's a chili dip that you dip with, it's sort of like Thai crudite.
But like really it's, spicy?
Oh my God, it's so good.
Is it like mouth on fire spicy though?
It's chili laden.
Not a raging inferno though.
No, not a raging inferno.
Well, that's good. All right. We're going to stay with the Asian theme that we've been talking about, off to Mid-City, a Korean cafe called Spoon by H.
And one of the things I love about Spoon by H is that I was going there for years just eating their desserts and their shaved ice, because that's what I've thought it was all these years, until David Chang started Instagramming that there's this secret menu. Well, I had no idea that there was this secret menu.
It's not
menu.
Secret anymore, Evan
no,
Kleiman.
It's not secret anymore. Yeah. So Chef Yujin Hwang, she's a former concert pianist. And so she originally opened it as a sweets cafe, but then, you know, she got a little itchy.
Is that where Spoon came from, by the way?
Yes. Yeah. Everything is a Spoon dessert.
Yeah.
But now she just let herself go crazy with really creative riffs on classic Korean homestyle dishes. So one of the things that everyone loves to get is the mandugook, which is a super delicious stew of dumplings, pork belly, and glass noodles in a milky white broth.
Ooh.
People also love her kimchi fried rice with really smoky bacon topped with a fried egg.
Oh, wow. That sounds delicious. I'm so hungry right now.
I know. It's really a torture.
There's another place in Echo Park on Sunset Boulevard, a restaurant there with a pretty unusual name. It's
Maze.
But it's literally the letters M-H-Z-H.
Yeah, well, because it's being transliterated from Hebrew. What do you want from me?
I don't know. I'm just asking the question. I just want to know more about Maze.
Maze, what is it? I have to say that if we're talking about restaurants that are barely restaurants, it's my dream restaurant.
Really?
Yeah, because it's just all the seating's on the street on Sunset Boulevard in Echo Park.
Yeah.
And going up the side street, which is on a hill.
Yeah.
So sometimes you're seated in a chair where you're slightly on a hill, but you don't care because the Israeli food is so unbelievable.
Okay.
Connor Shemtov is the chef, and because he doesn't have to deal with like the whole dining writ large, capital D, because of the improvisational nature of the seating at this restaurant, he can just concentrate on the food and deliver you an amazing menu of Israeli/Mediterranean specialties at a much more affordable price than other places in town that you really have to pay for. So, for example,
we're going to dinner. Yeah, what are we going to get?
Well, we're definitely going to get the hummus because however it comes, it's going to be fabulous. One of my favorite times I got it was there was a pool of melted brown butter and toasted hazelnuts in the center. And I think it was one of the first whole cabbages presented to me that I just looked at it and I thought, oh my, two of us are never going to be able to finish that. And we demolished it. It was braised in red wine and it was just like you ate it with a spoon.
A full cabbage.
But the menu is written on just like a brown bag and it changes, but it's not a big menu. Just two of us ordered everything on the menu. The desire to go back is strong.
Let's head to the Union Swap Meet. This is in East L.A., East Los, where a restaurant called Baru Canteen has set up this temporary shop.
Yes. Yeah, so once again, you can tell this is in the theme of improvisation. And, you know, there's so much has been written about Baru and his hyper-focused fermentation-influenced cuisine. Kwang Ah is the genius behind it. And this is a restaurant where he and his partner, Mina Park, are still cooking while they're looking for a more permanent, suitable location since they left their strip mall location of the original Baru. And once again, the thing you want to do is just eat whatever is on the menu. It's always interesting. And you're supporting people that you really want to stay in the culinary game here in LA. We don't want to lose them. So even though it's in this really strange spot, we need enough people to go there so that they can stick it out until they're ready to find another brick and mortar location.
All right, I'm going to pull out a 10 spot, Evan Kleiman. Here it is, right here. I'm putting it. We're going to go get some lunch at one of these places and sit on a stool and hopefully not fall down the street, right?
Yeah. His Korean-Italian mashups are genius,
really?
Too, I have to say.
Baruch Canteen over in East LA. Evan Kleiman, happy holidays to you. Happy eating.
And to you.
Good food. You can catch her on Saturdays from 11 to noon, anytime, of course, at kcrw.com/goodfood. Evan, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
We're going to be back with KCRW's Best of 2019. And coming up next, the Best of Television.
Well, back to our special, The Best of 2019. I'm Madeline Brand. Let's talk the best of TV with the hosts of KCRW's Screen Grab segment, Michael Schneider and Joe Adalian. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hi.
Well, you both brought a list of your favorite shows. Do they overlap?
There was some overlap, actually. There's a lot of great TV this year, so it's hard not to agree or disagree on certain things.
Well, let's talk about one that a lot of people seem to love, and that's HBO's Watchmen.
People who wear masks are driven by trauma. They're obsessed with justice because of some injustice they suffered. Ergo, the mask. It hides the pain.
I wear the mask to protect myself.
Right. From the pain.
Okay, so this is, how would you describe this show? The cops are wearing masks because a white supremacist group is killing cops or has killed cops.
Yeah, and it's basically a continuation of the Watchmen comic, which mm-hmm. also led to a movie at one point. It's sort of a sequel to some degree of that comic. Damon Lindelof, who of course we know from Lost and later from The Leftovers, mm-hmm. one of the greatest shows of this past decade, is now the executive producer of this. And so it's a mix of sort of sci-fi, comic book, but also a deep dive into racial relationships and racial issues. It goes deep into the history of this country. There's also a sort of post-apocalyptic feel to it. It's sort of a hodgepodge of all sorts of things, but it's fantastic. And Regina King, who's the star, is amazing. Give her all the awards.
Joe, you liked it too?
I really did. And you know, look, I'm predisposed to like something from Damon Lindelof ever since the days of Lost. The Leftovers, which he did for HBO, was also stellar. This one, the degree of difficulty was just tremendous for Watchmen. I mean, it was famously one of the hardest properties to translate to the screen. There was a movie about a decade ago that was sort of received a very with mixed response. But this, you know, I hate to sound like a judge on American Idol, but he made it his own, dog. I mean, he just sort of came in with it in his team, and it was a team effort, came in and put a spin on Watchmen that really made it feel relevant to now, as opposed to, you know, something from the 80s or 90s when it first was out as a graphic novel. It's a really great television.
Okay, next up, a solo pick from you, Michael. Fleabag, created by and starring Phoebe Waller-Bridge.
The only thing harder than having to tell your super high-powered, perfect, anorexic, rich super sister that you've run out of money is having to ask her to bail you out. I'm just going to ask her. I'm just going to come.
Do you need to borrow money?
No.
Phoebe Waller-Bridge, it's her year.
It is such a good show.
It is a fantastic show. Phoebe Waller-Bridge won the Emmy for both Best Actress in a Comedy, and also the show won for Best Comedy. It's a quick watch. It's a fun watch. I wish there was more. She still doesn't want to do any more future seasons. Maybe eventually we'll convince her, but she's got a big new deal at Amazon. She's doing all sorts of things right now, but this is the show that really made her, and it's so wonderfully done.
And so there are two seasons. The second season got pretty deep into religion and the nature of love and the nature of celibacy and the Catholic Church
It brought the hot priest into pop culture prominence. And so Andrew Scott, who stars as the hot priest, just got a nomination at the Golden Globes. He's fantastic in it as well. But yeah, there's a lot sort of layers. Again, a lot of these shows are so multi-layered, multifaceted, have great performances and have something to say.
All right, number three, moving on to a pick of yours, Joe, Tuca and Birdie, an animated Netflix series voiced by Tiffany Haddish and Ali Wong.
You're about to get Tuca.
Tuca? Tuca? Tuca?
Oh,
I miss you!
Birdie! 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 You're my best friend. You're smart.
Ka-pow!
And you're so bright! Wearing an article of clothing that's impossible to pee in.
I just pull it to the side.
All right, Joe, what is this show about?
You know, it's basically, it's first of all, it's from Lisa Hannawalt, who was a writer and producer on BoJack Horseman, also on Netflix. And it takes that, you know, animal world sensibility and translates it to two 30-year-old bird women. You know, one is a toucan, another is a songbird. And they're basically two 30-something women sort of living in, not really New York, but in some animated world. You know, and it's sort of, think of it as girls, but with birds and animated. And it was just so incredibly well done. It was visually one of the most impressive shows I've seen this year. And there was a lot of great animation on television in 2019. But it was just, it was funny. It was surreal. It took a minute to get into it. But once you did, it was sort of perfect. And unfortunately, though, you know, Netflix did not do a great job selling it. No one apparently watched by the Netflix metrics, and they canceled it, which was unfortunately part of a trend for Netflix this year of canceling things after just one season, which is really a shame. I hope some way, some other future streaming service finds a way to revive it.
Right. And we don't really know what the ratings are because Netflix doesn't say.
We never know.
We don't. So it's a dark
We just
hole.
Know that they were not big enough for Netflix to bring it back.
So. Okay, well, that's too bad. Finally, another show that has overlap between the two of you. You both love this one. It's called Succession, an HBO show that is loosely based on the Murdochs.
I want a broadcast network. I don't want to see what other news operations we can sweep up.
Local TV?
Dad, nobody watches TV.
Why shouldn't we do all the news?
Well, Kim Jong-pop, because that's not how things work in this country.
That's some good writing there.
This was the obsession of the year, right? I mean, I don't know if you were talking all about it here at Press Play, but we love this show, especially in the media, those of us who cover the media for a living. But it's just delicious. It's funny. It's interesting. It's soapy. It's smart. Some great acting from, you know, a number of the people that you heard in that clip, Brian Cox, Kieran Culkin, Jeremy Strong. It's just, it was the show, one of the shows of the year.
Joe?
And, you know, what's great about it is, and, you know, people at HBO would never admit this, but it's basically Dynasty done HBO style. It's Dynasty with a little bit of Empire. It's most of all a soap opera. It has some very good writing, has amazing acting, but at its heart, it's a soap opera about family power. And of course, in the 80s, Dynasty did that incredibly well. And Succession is doing it now with a little bit of a high-class HBO sheen to it, but it's just people watch on a week-to-week basis because they want to see what happens next with this insane family, what twists are going to happen, like Boar on the Floor, which you have to see to believe. And it shows how broad of a year HBO had in terms of drama, that the same, you know, network that, you know, gets something as sort of out there and weird as Watchmen can also do something that's basically just an unabashed soap opera in Succession.
Yeah, it was one of those things where people were concerned about HBO after Game of Thrones went off. But if you look at the gamut of shows that they have now, including, I mean, two that we mentioned, Succession and Watchmen, with more to come, it's still a great time to be at HBO and watching HBO.
Succession, will there be another season?
Yeah.
So season three is coming
I think
up.
this is going to be one of their new sort of tentpole shows now. And I think they really appreciate the fact that it's an awards getter. It's a show that people are talking about, and it does quite well with viewers.
Okay, so overall, what can we expect in the next year on television?
Yeah, I would say the big story in 2020 is something that started at the end of 2019, which is the expansion of the streaming universe. You know, as opposed to the big three of Netflix, Hulu, and Amazon's Prime Video, we now have Apple TV Plus, we now have Disney Plus, and coming up in 2020, we're going to have Comcast's Peacock, which is a streaming service, as well as HBO Max from Warner Media. And you're suddenly going to see sort of the world of television really revolve around five or six major streamers, and the battle to get and keep subscribers. And of course, for the old world of broadcast and basic cable to hold on, which is going to be the biggest challenge for them as people start to decide whether or not it's finally time to cut the cord and stop paying for massive cable bundles and instead go with maybe five or six streaming services.
Which may end up costing the same or more, right?
Yeah, yeah. And there's more on the way. And what's also going to be interesting in the coming year is that you're going to have all these new services battling the attention of people who are also focused on the presidential campaign. And there's going to be another Olympics next year. There's going to be a lot of noise in the media landscape next year. 2020 is going to blow all of our minds.
Oh, my gosh.
No pressure.
Dramatic, Mike.
Wow, that is pretty dramatic.
You know, we were talking about entertainment, drama, so why
yeah,
not?
So why not
life,
bring it here?
Life is the biggest reality show.
Michael Schneider, Joe Adalian, hosts of KCRW's Screen Grab. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We will have more of KCRW's Best of 2019 coming up. Steve Chiotakis is back to talk best documentaries with Matt Holzman, host of KCRW's The Document.
We're back on KCRW's Best of 2019. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Happy holidays to you. This is the show where Madeline Brand and I are talking to KCRW tastemakers about their picks for their favorite art and music and culture this year. And joining me now to talk about the best documentaries of the year is Matt Holzman. He's the host of KCRW's nonfiction screening series called The Document. Matt, happy holidays to you.
Same to you, Steve.
All right, so last week the Academy narrowed down its long list of 159 documentary entries to 15 films, eligible to be one of the five final nominees. What do you think of their choices?
Well, I'll say there's four of the...
You have an opinion about this, don't you?
I absolutely do. Four of my five picks for the best of the year are on their list. So I agree with it mostly, but
that's of course, very nice.
There's plenty of room for disagreement, and documentaries are incredibly, incredibly diverse kind of film. So there's everything from the kind of polemic, political diatribe to things that are memoirs. They're just all over the place. So there's something for everyone on this list. I think it's a pretty great list, as it always is.
Let's talk about your favorite five. I'm starting with American Factory. Okay.
Now, I want to say these are alphabetical.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's like your children. You don't put anyone in front of the other. Right?
I have my favorites, but we don't tell them.
American Factory, that starts with an A. It's about a Chinese company that comes to the Rust Belt and reopens a GM factory that had been shut down. The plant is in Dayton, Ohio, and it makes auto glass.
Where you sit today used to be a General Motors plant, and now there are over 1,000 employees working here.
Is this a union shop?
It is our desire to not be.
So this is a film that is directed by Stephen Pogner and Julia Reichert, who are two filmmakers who have been around since the 70s making extraordinary films. And interestingly enough, I think this may be the most extraordinary film they've ever made. It's one of those films that you're watching and you think, did he just say that? Does he know there's a camera there? But you're watching a story that's not about labor and not about globalization, but it's about culture clash. And it's just a fascinating film from beginning to end.
We're talking about a time, now we're in a trade war, by the way, with China and have been for months. A lot of Americans think that China is this big rising world power and is a big threat to America and perhaps even democracy. So how did the locals in the Buckeye state of Ohio react to this Chinese company coming in and opening up and running their factory?
Well, the factory was closed for a number of years. The Chinese come in, they completely reinvigorate it, and people are getting their jobs back, so they're very optimistic. But as the Chinese trainers come in, they start to see that their way of doing things and the American way of doing things are incredibly different. And again, this is not a movie about globalization, really. It's a movie about culture clash. And you see on a very personal level, at the employee level, at the people who are working in the line, how they're trying to accommodate each other as best they can. But it is very difficult because they see the world and they see the world of work completely differently. It's also fascinating because I think perhaps the Chinese are not as hyper aware of the camera as Americans tend to be. So they are either that or perhaps the fact that they're speaking Chinese and they feel like people don't understand what they're saying. I really don't understand it, but they are saying things about American workers that would be shockingly honest for an American to say about a Chinese worker. We would just never say it. And in a way, the honesty creates this kind of friction, but also a dialogue and understanding how when these cultures come together, it creates this just explosion of differences. And people at the lowest, at the top levels, not so much, but at the bottom levels, they're trying to work it out as best they can. But it's a very difficult road to hoe.
I want to talk more about American ingenuity, and we're still in A's, by the way. Yeah. This is Apollo 11, which is the story of Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, Michael Collins, their 1969 mission to put the first man on the moon, obviously a national legend that most of us know pretty well, but maybe we haven't seen it quite like this.
The whole Apollo program was designed to get two Americans to the lunar surface and back again to Earth safely. The enormity of this event is something that only history will be able to judge.
The Apollo 11 mission was filmed by about 10 billion people, and a good number of those people, I'm exaggerating a slight bit, but a lot of those people had widescreen 65-millimeter cameras, you know, like at the Cinerama Dome. Almost all of that footage was cut down, recut, repackaged, reformatted for use in all sorts of different ways, but the original footage has almost never been seen. So now you're seeing, from the first moment of in this movie, where the rocket is on the gantry and being rolled out to where it's going to be launched, you take a gasp because you cannot believe the scale of what they're about to try to do. And the movie tells that story of how impossible, how incredibly optimistic it was for Americans to try to do this thing, and how close we came to having a total disaster on our hands, but yet we managed to pull it off. I just have to say, it comes back to IMAX occasionally, and if anybody has a chance to see it in IMAX, I beg you to please go and see it.
Well, next up is Hail Satan, with a question mark at the end, a film about the modern satanic temple. Let's listen.
It's a beautiful day here at the state capitol. Great day to be a Satanist.
We're gonna go to hell!
I believe it, and I'm very excited about it.
Hail Satan!
We're not what you think we are.
As a Satanist, I believe that confronting injustice is an expression of one's satanic faith.
We want people to evaluate the United States being a Christian nation. It's not.
So this is a film that's an incredible counterpoint to Apollo 11 in a way. This is a film that is none of that can-do American spirit. It's that can-do American snark. This is a group of people, a subversive, funny, thought-provoking group of people who are asking about what our country was built on and what it stands for now. In a way, they're activists for pluralism in the country. And Penny Lane has created a movie that is kind of as funny and thought-provoking and subversive as the group itself.
I remember when you were screening this and the talk that you were giving in at the radio station and even the promos that you made for it. It was like, it's unlike anything you've ever seen.
Well, I think that's true because, you know, the idea is they're Satanists, which sounds very dark. And the truth of the matter is, while they've taken on this word chosen carefully, cloak of Satanism, what they really are is a very politically active organization for making sure that this country stands true to its original promises of pluralism. And by bringing in this satanic element, they get everybody's hackles up so fast and so hard. I mean, what's interesting about it is that they use the holier-than-thou attitudes of many politicians against themselves. I mean, they're dead serious in what they're trying to accomplish, but they're so funny in the way they go about doing it. And this movie has so much life. It's really fun to watch.
Tell us more about the Satanic Temple. I mean, they're not actually Satanists, right? They're not devil worshipers.
They are absolutely devil worshipers.
They
but
are?
What that means to you and what it means to them might be very different things.
Okay.
Because they don't see Satan necessarily as a representative of evil. They see him as a prankster. They see Satan as a symbol of challenging the status quo. And also, we mentioned in the intro that the movie has a question mark after it. It's Hail Satan question mark. And that's because a lot of people were uncomfortable with the idea of putting Hail Satan exclamation point. They felt that people wouldn't go see the movie and distributors wouldn't carry it. Now, why? Because it has the word Satan in it? Are we that provincial that we're scared because a movie has the word Satan in it? But ironically, I think the filmmaker Penny Lane, who is really a talented woman, she did not want the question mark. I don't want to speak for her. I don't believe she wanted it. But I think after the fact, she's realized that it actually accomplished something, which is to let people know that this movie has a sense of humor. It's tongue-in-cheek. It has seriousness. But the point is for the viewer to judge for yourself. And that is what the Satanic Temple is actually trying to do as well.
Next on our alphabetized list is a documentary called Honeyland. Which we won't play a clip of because it's all in Macedonian and Turkish and Serbo-Croatian. Tell us what Honeyland is about.
So two filmmakers, Tamara Katevska and Lubomir Stefanov, have made a film about a woman who collects honey from the wild bees in the hills around her simple shack where she lives with her elderly blind mother. And this is not the greatest elevator pitch for a movie ever. No, but...
We love the bees, though, right?
Well, it's emotional. It's beautiful. It talks about the nature, the balance of nature. It takes you to a place that you have never seen and could not possibly imagine. Both a physical place, these Macedonian hills where this woman is walking on the cliffs to take away rocks and find the bees and take their honey from them, but also a kind of an emotional place where people live in a way that is not like the way we live at all.
Oh, it's a war-torn area, right?
But it's simple, yeah. And it's very connected to the earth. The movie is really about being in the rhythm of nature and living a life that is appropriate to who you are and where you are and what it is that you want to be.
M stands for maiden. That's our last movie that we're going to talk about. It's a story of a young woman who burst onto the scene of male-dominated round-the-world yacht racing, and she did it with an all-female crew.
The Whitbread race is underway.
We weren't naive. We knew it was going to be hard.
We didn't think they would even finish the first leg.
It was something that we were told we couldn't do, but we were doing it anyway.
It was the first time in my life I had stood up for something I believed in. And the harder it became, the more I wanted to do it.
So in 1989, a young woman named Tracy Edwards decided she was going to take on the world in the Whitbread Round the World race. And this is a grueling... The race doesn't exist anymore in this exact form, but I believe at the time it was 7 or 8 legs around the world, England to England, maybe 35,000 nautical miles. Truly a death-defying, grueling race, of which there was maybe 1 or 2 women on any of the boats that were in this race. And she decided she's going to find a boat, outfit it, get a female crew, and they're going to do it. And of course, she was... absolutely poo-pooed. People thought she was out of her mind. Luckily, they brought cameras on board.
Yeah.
And that footage got spread to the four corners of the earth. And filmmaker Alex Holmes met Tracy Edwards when she came to speak at his child's school.
Oh, how cool.
And asked her, you know, where's the footage? And she's like, I don't know. And he proceeded to go and find this extraordinary footage of the race and create a movie that, first of all, it's a great story. The footage is amazing. Every woman on this crew is like the most amazing woman you've ever, you know, met. And at the beginning, where they were so shunned by the male-dominated racing community, by the end, both the racing community and the public at large had completely taken them into their hearts. And listen, if you have teenage kids, especially if you have a girl, a teenage daughter, please go see this movie. You will have the best time.
Matt Holzman hosts KCRW's nonfiction screening series, The Document. You can find, by the way, his 5 favorite docs of 2019, including information about where you can see those docs at kcrw.com/bestofculture. Matt Holzman, happy new year to you, by the way.
Same to you. Thanks for having me on.
We'll be back in a moment with more of KCRW's Best of 2019. Joining Madeline Brand, next, the bookworm, Michael Silverblatt.
I'm Madeline Brand, back with our special, The Best of KCRW 2019, and Michael Silverblatt is with me now with his favorite books of the past year. He hosts, of course, KCRW's Bookworm. Hey there, Michael.
Hey there, Madeline.
Was it a good year for books?
You know, it was a great year for books. I would say especially, this is unusual, a great year for poetry.
Oh, interesting. Well, you have some picks for poetry on your list. But first, let's talk about a big novel. It came out pretty early on in 2019, Black Leopard, Red Wolf by Marlon James.
Oh, that's probably the most amusing, entertaining book you could read right now. You know, that author, he's Jamaican, and he won... he was the first Jamaican to win the Booker Prize. It's the quintessential British prize, so it was really a breakthrough. And then he announced he was beginning a series of fantasy novels. I thought, oh no, a trilogy of fantasy novels. Well, it's the funniest thing, the most musical thing, and it's stitched together out of African folklore.
I want to just play a quick clip of tape of Marlon James speaking with you earlier this year.
The stories I was reading, the African stories, were so amoral. They were so sexual. They're so fluid. They villains don't always get their comeuppance. Heroes aren't really heroes. The person who's telling the story is actually lying to you.
So he's really playing with the trickster character in myth.
The trickster, but also, you know, the whole shape of the African folk tales he found is a shape that we're not used to. It's not our fairy tale shape. It's a brand new language and shape for storytelling that makes us fascinated with the possibilities that we've overlooked in the course of making this, you know, white canon. He introduces us to a whole new floating world.
Okay, so that is Marlon James, Black Leopard, Red Wolf. Let's move on to another one on your list. And this was a novel I actually also interviewed the author of. We both interviewed her, Eun Lee. And her, I guess it's not really a novel. It's kind of a novel slash memoir called Where Reasons End. And describe this book and why it made your best of list.
It was the most moving book I've read in the last decade. It is a novel in the sense that Eun Lee had, in fact, lost a child, a very brilliant young man. And she decided to write a novel in which there would be a certain kind of never-never-land limbo in which a parent could speak to a dead child and ask the questions that you never get to ask. Now, this is a very, very sensitive writer. So among the things she's asking her son, may I look at the poems you left behind on your computer? May I have the right to know the things that we never said? And I thought it was important that we have a book that addresses one of our barely bearable subjects. She does it with honor, she does it without despair, and she does it with clarity and bravery. I thought it was a beautiful book.
I did too. I loved it. And it sounds on the face of it like, oh, maybe you don't want to read this because it's dealing with such heavy material, but it's written with a kind of lightness too. And it's just beautiful to spend time with her.
Lightness, grace, and humor, because the boy and his mother have all the problems that boys and mothers have in talking to each other, even from beyond the grave. So their breakthroughs are real breakthroughs.
Yeah. Let's just play a little clip from her interview with you.
Parenting is to stay in realism. You have to be realistic. You have to do everything in this concrete way, in this real world. But parenting sometimes stops, or, you know, a child dies. And all of a sudden, you take a leave from realism. And you have to find yourself somewhere to go.
That's Eun Lee talking about her novel, Where Reasons End, which made Michael Silverblatt's Best of 2019 list. Turning now to poetry, you said this was a great year for poetry. I want you to talk about Terrence Hayes' book. It's called American Sonnets for My Past and Future Assassin.
What a book, Madeline. You know, you have to think twice before you make a best of list that has poetry on it, and I have three books of poetry on mine. This one was written in the spirit of Rhonda Coleman, who was a Los Angeles poet. She invented what she called the American sonnet. It didn't have those complicated rhyme schemes, stanzas, and couplets. What it was is breaking in to an American subject in an unforgettable way. And what Terrence Hayes did was to write a sonnet a day for the first 3 months since Trump became president. And I just read this book in laughter and tears. Terrence is a really special case. He wasn't a poet. He went to college on a basketball fellowship and discovered that he loved poetry there and started writing and writing and writing and writing, and his poems knock me out. I think he's really one of the most exciting writers in American life today.
Let's hear him read one of his poems. This is him, Terrence Hayes, reading from his latest collection on your program.
I lock you in an American sonnet that is part prison, part panic closet, a little room and a house set aflame. I lock you in a form that is part music box, part meat grinder to separate the song of the bird from the bone. I lock your persona in a dream-inducing sleeper hold while your better selves watch from the bleachers. I make you both gem and crow here. As the crow, you undergo a beautiful catharsis trapped one night in the shadows of the gem. As the gem, the feel of crow dropping to your floors is not unlike the stars falling from the pep rally posters on your walls. I make you a box of darkness with a bird in its heart. Voltas of acoustics, instinct, and metaphor. It is not enough to love you. It is not enough to want you destroyed.
Terrence Hayes reading the title poem from his book, American Sonnets for My Past and Future Assassin. Michael?
I'm kind of awestruck to hear his voice again reading that poem. I mean, that's what you want from a poet, and that's what we need in our time. I was so happy to be exposed to that book. I hadn't read him before, but once I did, I got all of his books, and they're all good. This is a major American poet. People are always saying, who are the new American poets? Terrence Hayes, Terrence Hayes, Terrence Hayes.
All right, just a few of Michael Silverblatt's selections from his best books of 2019. You can see the entire list at kcrw.com/culture. Michael, thank you.
Thank you, Madeline. It's a pleasure.
Michael Silverblatt, he's host of KCRW's Bookworm. It airs every Thursday afternoon at 1:30 on KCRW. Coming up, Steve Chiotakis speaks with Francis Anderton of KCRW's DNA about the best design of 2019.
Onward now with KCRW's Best of 2019. I'm Steve Chiotakis. We're going to talk now about LA's changing landscape. It's consistently the land of tearing down the old and building the new, but it's also, LA is, a town of rebirth and renewal. The second act, as it were. Makeovers, which happened a lot in this past year. Many spaces and buildings got patched up or refurbished or redone. Or they're in the process of it. And DNA's Francis Anderton is here to run down the best LA makeovers of this past year. Hello, Francis.
Hello, Steve.
And happy holidays, by the way.
And to you.
Why makeovers? Why do you think that designers and developers have been upgrading spaces and buildings as opposed to just, I mean, what we normally do in LA is just knock them down?
Makeovers was actually something that was suggested to me by a real estate developer that I was speaking to a while back, who just said that back in the day, if you were developing in LA in the 20th century, you had a lot of virgin land to play with. That's not the case in LA now. Developers are trying to shoehorn in residential developments and other kinds of developments. And now sort of the buzzwords are infill, you know, rather than virgin land. So I was just so intrigued by that. And I was looking back over some of the stories that we'd done this year and realized that several of them fell into this kind of category called makeover. So several of them fell into this category of retrofitting, patching over, in some way finding a kind of ingenious way to give a new life to an existing place.
Let's talk about a few of them here. You compiled a list. The first one, and our first stop, I guess, is in Culver City.
That's right. And stop being the operative word, because it's actually the Culver City Station. And if you get out at the Culver City Station off of the Expo line and you go downstairs and then you cross over Washington Boulevard, you find yourself at a quite really interesting retail destination called Platform. Well, they've added on to this sort of tastefully curated mall a rather surprising little park. And this little park that they have come up with, this is the developers, David Fishbein and Joseph Miller. They brought in some really good landscape designers, Echo Park based Terremoto. They brought in textile designers, Block Shop. Between the landscape designers and the textile designers, they've wound up with this cute little park plus a very bright, cheerful mural that's on the back end of the platform development. And they've created this little tucked away garden in a space where you don't expect to find it. So therein lies its charm.
Another space that you mentioned is a type of, this is an anti-WeWork kind of space in Hollywood.
Well, that's what the owner would like you to see it as. He's called Rohan Silva, and he and his partner, Sam Aldenton, they are the co-founders of Second Home. That is a shared working space that originated in London. They have several spots there. They have spots in Lisbon, and now they have opened up in LA, Second Home Hollywood. At every step of the way, they have worked with a Spanish design firm called Selgas Cano that's doing some other projects in LA as well. Selgas Cano absolutely loves plastic. And what they have done in this space is something incredibly interesting. They took a colonial revival building that was designed by the revered architect Paul Williams, plus the adjacent surface parking lot. Mm-hmm. They turned that whole lot into this complex that consists of a remodeled Paul Williams building. And then in this huge surface parking lot, they have transformed that into essentially a garden of circular acrylic pods with yellow roofs separated by winding paths that are lined with potted plants that give a kind of jungly effect. It's completely surprising, unexpected. It also, I should say, separates itself a bit by having a public dimension. You can go in there if you're not a member. You can use the bookstore, you can use the cafeteria, you can sit in some of its open areas, and you can kind of bask in this sort of pop modern design by Selgas Cano that's really imaginative.
Speaking of basking, there's a lot of sunshine that you could typically bask in at the Crystal Cathedral down in Orange County that was also remade into something new.
That's right. And that was really a surprise. So Crystal Cathedral is super famous because of the famed televangelist Robert Schuller, who preached from there and on people's TV screens for many years. It was designed by an architect called Philip Johnson, hugely important figure in American architecture. And he created essentially a glass diamond. It was completely see-through. It was totally bright. You were in a goldfish bowl when you were in that space. But it was most definitely considered an architectural landmark. The firm Johnson Fain was asked by the building's new owners, the Roman Catholic Diocese of Orange County, that acquired the building in 2012, to please turn this completely see-through building into something more suited to the Catholic liturgy. Well, what Johnson Fain came up with was really a surprising and really ingenious kind of solution. They basically, in their words, built a boat within a boat. And that was, they put an inner layer inside the entirety of this glass shell. And that inner layer is a screen. It's a kind of diaphanous screen of 11,000 steel powder-coated plastic and fabric squares. These are then bifurcated, so they're into triangles. So there's these slits, and through the slits of every single one of these squares that they're calling quatrefoils, which is a symbol within the Catholic Church, you get this amazing light. It's really stunning. And in that sense, they have taken the building down in terms of light, but they have elevated it, I would argue, in terms of spirituality.
Interesting. There's a place back in Los Angeles, Santa Monica Boulevard, the Formosa Cafe. Long time, right? Venerable place right there, just on the cusp of the city of L.A. in West Hollywood, I believe. It closed, but then was reborn.
Yes, and most of the makeovers we've been talking about have taken a site that did one thing and turned it into another thing. The Formosa Cafe takes the Formosa Cafe and recreates it as the Formosa Cafe.
Well, there you
but,
go. Hollywood reinvents itself.
That's right. But what makes it interesting is who was responsible for it. It's a group called the 1933 Group. They are developer designers who strip places back that may have 7 decades of history, and they try and pull from that 7 decades the pieces of history that they think tell the story of that place. And then they overlay features that make it more contemporary. And that's what they've done with the Formosa Cafe. So they've kept, you know, memorable parts of the decor, the black and white headshots that we all remember, the silk lanterns, the green neon Route 66 sign. They've got rid of the chop suey font, which is considered not quite so appropriate these days. But the whole thing feels like, in some ways, you feel like you're walking onto the set of the Formosa Cafe, and yet it's gone back to being a noisy diner, and there are the booths still welcoming you in. So,
and the pictures on the wall and all of that.
And the pictures on the wall. Yes, yes. So yes, the Formosa Cafe, an oldie but goodie.
All right, KCRW's Frances Anderton, who hosts Design and Architecture Tuesdays at 1:30. Frances, thank you.
You're so welcome, Steve.
All right, stay right there. We're going to be back in just a moment with more of KCRW's Best of 2019. And coming up next, the best of music.
Back now with our Best of KCRW special. I'm Madeline Brand. We're going to end now with some music. And this year, our DJs compiled their best albums, their best songs, artists of the year, and of the decade. No surprise, lots of LA-based artists are on those lists. We're going to talk about that now with KCRW DJ Ann Litt. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, let's begin with Best of the Year.
There were so many LA artists Best of the Year, but I brought you 3 Best of debuts that ended up at the top for KCRW.
Okay, well, let's begin with Automatic. Tell us about this group.
Automatic is a trio of women based in the east side of LA, and they put out a debut album called Signal. Signal came out on September the 27th, so just a couple of months ago,
yeah.
And it immediately rocketed to the top of our charts. It's on my best of year-end list, it's on Travis Holcomb's best year-end list, and it's on our overall KCRW best of list. They're clearly influenced by bands like New Order and ESG, and it's just a really fresh return to post-punk kind of sound.
What song did you bring?
Strange Conversations by Automatic.
Strange conversations. Have you talking to the world? I thought I told you.
And it does sound very 80s.
It does.
Very synthy 80s.
Well, you know, there have been a few bands this year who've released albums in that vein, but for some reason, they don't feel derivative at all to me. They just feel like a fresh take on a different era.
And they were on live here recently.
They were just on Morning Becomes Eclectic, mm-hmm. and I had a chance to check in with them. And I think one of the themes you're going to see running through our best of this year are sort of collaborations. And one of the things I took note of when I spoke to Automatic was that they are an integral part of this scene that sort of popped up around the club in East LA called Zebulon. I actually asked them to put together their dream bill of artists at Zebulon, and they had a lot of great ideas, all local, all from that crowd, you know, artists like Ty Siegel and The OCs and Shannon Lay and a number of others who just kind of almost work together interchangeably. Mm. And it's sort of that club scene that's brought them together. So yet another great collaboration, this time between some artists and a scene that inspires them. Of course, they also wanted New Order on their bill, which I fully endorsed.
Well, speaking of the east side of LA, you've brought another artist who people probably have heard of, maybe once or twice,
mm-hmm.
Billie Eilish.
She, along with her producer and brother Phineas, have set probably a family record for Grammy nominations in 1 year. But Billie Eilish really got her start in 2015 when she was 14 years old right here on KCRW. That's when we played her for the very first time.
Wow, 14.
Yeah. And her brother and producer was 17 or 18. And now they are, you know, they've aged a lot. Now they're sort of 17 and 22. And
middle-aged by now.
And her debut album came out. He produced it. And he's nominated. Actually, he's he's now passed Lauryn Hill as the youngest producer of the year ever nominated for a single album.
Okay, let's hear a song from Billie Eilish, her hit called Bad Guy.
White shirt, now red, my bloody nose sleeping. You're on your tippy toes creeping around like no one knows. Think you're so criminal. Bruises on both my knees for you. Don't say thank you. Oh, please, I do what I want when I'm wanting to. My soul, so cynical. So you're a tough guy, like you're really rough guy. Just can't get enough guy, just always so puff guy. I'm that bad type, make your mama sad type. Make your girlfriend mad type, might seduce your dad type. I'm the bad guy. Duh.
So this was her debut album. It's called When We Fall Asleep, Where Do We Go? And then her brother and producer, Phineas, also released his debut, which is interestingly titled Blood Harmony. So when you think about the thoughts about collaboration, they each had their debut. They're each incredible, and they're both showcased as great songwriters and performers.
And we know he produces her. Does she also work on his stuff, or is he solo?
He's solo, but there is a constant back and forth between the two. He'll be the first one to tell you that she figures prominently in his solo work as he does in hers. I mean, it's still sort of this whole family affair, regardless of whether they are literally on each other's songs or not.
Well, especially because they grew up in the same house.
Yeah.
They were homeschooled. They spent a lot of time together working on music.
I don't know much about homeschooling, but there's something about the two of them that's really wise beyond their years. And the way they interact with each other and the give and the take is something I don't see with seasoned performers decades older. So I'm not sure what that is, but I would argue that he has made, obviously he produced it, her solo debut better, as has she to him.
Let's hear a track from his album called I Lost a Friend.
I lost a friend, like keys in a sofa, like a wallet in the backseat, like ice in the summer heat. I lost a friend, like sleep on a red eye, like money on a bad bed, like time worrying about every bad thing that hasn't happened yet.
I think this is one of these songs that you can sort of interpret into your life in any way you want. It could be a literal loss, or it could be just the loss of something small, loss of a friendship, the loss of your keys in the sofa, whatever it is. I think one of the beautiful things about this song is you can scale it any way that works for you inside your soul.
I lost my mind, and nobody believes me, saying no that he don't need me. 'Cause he made a little too much money to be 20 and sad, and I'll be fine without him. But all I do is write about him. How the hell did I lose a friend I never had?
So he was on Press Play this summer, and I asked him about that song and what he was talking about, and this is what he said.
Last summer, we'd been on tour for a couple months, and I came back and I had this best friend who I'd been best friends with since I was like 14. And I was like, I'm back. Let's hang out. Let's, you know, grab some coffee. And he was like, no. But, you know, I think we just had grown apart. And, you know, we started out in a very similar place at 14. And we ended up in kind of different places at 21.
Yeah, probably. Since he's a big star. Right.
Yeah, but that friend is sorry he didn't go for coffee with Phineas, right? But that's what I think is the beauty of, I think, Billie Eilish's music and Phineas's music, and maybe they bring that to each other, is that they can take something as simple as that and create something really beautiful out of just a very simple thought.
Okay, so let's talk about your favorites of the entire decade.
Well, this is an interesting one because it comes back to this idea of collaboration that we've been talking about. You know, you get to the end of the decade and you start looking back at what are some of the most important albums of the decade. And we got together, all the KCRW DJs got together actually at my house on a Saturday morning, and we all ate breakfast and drank Too Much Coffee and argued about what were some of the best albums of the decade. And the two LA-based artists that appeared on this list are Kamasi Washington and his album The Epic, and Kendrick Lamar and his album To Pimp a Butterfly, both of which came out in 2015.
And these two collaborate together on their albums.
Completely. Kamasi Washington plays saxophone on Kendrick Lamar's album. And Kendrick Lamar really brings a sort of jazz sensibility to what he's doing, especially on To Pimp a Butterfly. But these scenes are so intertwined. In fact, I heard an interview with Kamasi Washington where he talks about, you know, being heavily into jazz as a very young kid, sort of getting all of his friends into it, Thundercat, all these guys. And they were like these 10-year-olds who were heavily into jazz. And him saying that once he discovered hip hop, I mean, he originally was listening to hip hop, but once he sort of really started paying attention to hip hop, he realized all the samples that these guys had taken from some of the great jazz albums. So it, the whole thing is sort of woven in and out of each other. And just like Billie Eilish and Phineas, I think that Kamasi and Kendrick were collaborating, yes, consciously, as Kamasi played on To Pimp a Butterfly, but also just spiritually. I think there's this sort of spiritual and intellectual collaboration. Both of these artists, again, wise beyond their years and incorporating such a bigger world into their what could be a straight ahead jazz project and what could be a straight ahead hip hop project. And that's what I find so exciting about these two albums.
So this is Kamasi.
Yeah, it's really a new generation of jazz. It's jazz for the kids. No, it is. I mean, look, I was last year all hot and bothered about what I was seeing going on in London with jazz. And I went to a jazz show with an English jazz band called Ezra Collective. And the audience ranged in age from people my parents' age to 20-year-olds. And everybody equally into it. And they're using elements of hip-hop and traditional jazz. And that's what these guys are doing here. But they're doing in a totally West Coast, Southern California way.
Yeah.
It's different from London. It's different from New York.
Right. Totally. It's LA.
Yeah.
And I love that you brought all LA artists today.
Well, I don't know if it's an accident or not, but the fact that three LA artists with debuts were among some of our best albums of the year, and two artists on our best of the decade, which also included some incredibly notable artists on the other hand, like Solange and The War on Drugs and Adele. But two of the most important albums to us were by two Los Angeles artists released the same year who both heavily influenced each other, Kamasi Washington and Kendrick Lamar. And that is outstanding. That is outstanding. Where you and I was walking, now I run again, got the whole world talking. King culture, everybody wanna cut the legs off. King culture, black man taking no losses. Oh yeah. Where you and I was walking, now I run again, got the whole world talking. King Kendrick Lamar, King Kunta, and Lit. You're the best. Happy New Year. You're the best. Happy New Year to you. And let's listen to some good music together over the holidays.
Yes, indeedy. Manipulated Bill Clinton with desires. 24/7, 365 days times two. I was contemplating getting on stage just to go back to the hood, see my enemy and say, oh yeah. Where you and I was walking, now I run again, got the whole world talking. King culture, everybody wanna cut the legs off.
Well, that was a lot of fun, Madeline Brand.
Well, thanks. It was a lot of fun. And hey, happy holidays to you.
Happy holidays to you, too.
Thank you.
You can find all of our lists, by the way, that you heard in this program at kcrw.com/bestofculture. I'm Steve Giotakis.
And I'm Madeline Brand, and I will see you tomorrow.